to get rid of the cooking smells, and stood there, looking at the trains and the shining tracks. The cold dissipated the warmth of the apartment, but it didn't bother her. It gave her energy. Stefano returned, and they sat down at the table. Irritated because he had been deprived of his mother's good cooking, he didn't say a single word in praise of the lunch, but was harsher than usual toward his brother-in-law, Reno, and more affectionate than usual toward his nephew. He kept calling him my sister's son, as if Reno's contribution had been of little account. When they got to the pastries, he ate three, she none. Stefano carefully wiped the cream off his mouth and said, "Let's go to bed for a while." Lila answered, "Starting tomorrow, I'm not going to the shop anymore." Stefano immediately understood that the afternoon was taking a bad turn.
"Why?"
"Because I don't feel like it."
"Did you fight with Michele and Marcello?"
"No."
"Lina, don't talk nonsense. You know very well that your brother and I are just one step from a violent clash with them. Don't complicate things."
"I'm not complicating anything, but I'm not going there anymore." Stefano was silent, and Lila saw that he was worried, that he wanted to escape without examining the matter. Her husband was afraid she was about to reveal to him some insult on the part of the Solatas, an unforgivable offense to which, once he knew about it, he would have to react, leading to an irrevocable rupture, which he couldn't afford.
"All right,"
he said, when he made up his mind to speak.
"Don't go. Go back to the grocery."
She answered, "I don't feel like the grocery either." Stefano looked at her in bewilderment.
"You want to stay home? Good. You wanted to work. I never asked you. Is that true or not?"
"It's true."
"Then stay home. I'd be glad to have you at home."
"I don't want to stay home either." He was close to losing his calm, the only way he knew to expel anxiety.
"If you don't want to stay home either, am I allowed to know what the fuck you want?"
Lila answered, "I want to go."
"Go where?"
"I don't want to stay with you anymore. I want to leave you." The only thing Stefano could do was start laughing. Those words seemed to him so enormous that for a few minutes he seemed relieved. He pinched her cheek. He said, with his usual half-smile, that they were husband and wife, and that husband and wife don't leave each other. He promised that the following Sunday he would take her to the Amalfi Coast so they could relax a little. But she answered calmly that there was no reason to stay together, that she had been wrong from the start, that even when they were engaged, she had liked him only a little, that she now knew clearly that she had never loved him, and that to be supported by him, to help him make money, to sleep with him, were things that she could no longer tolerate. It was at the end of that speech that she received a blow that knocked her off her chair. She got up while Stefano moved to grab her. She ran to the sink, seized the knife that she had put under the dish towel. She turned to him just when he was about to hit her again. "Do it, and I'll kill you the way they killed your father," she said. Stefano stopped, stunned by that reference to the fate of his father. He muttered things like,
"All right, kill me, do what you want."
And he made a gesture of boredom and yawned, an uncontrollable yawn, his mouth wide open, that left his eyes bright and shining. He turned his back on her and, still muttering resentfully,
"Go on, go. I've given you everything. I've yielded in every way, and you repay me like this? Me, who raised you out of poverty, who made your brother rich, your father and your whole shitty family."
Went to the table and ate another pastry. Then he left the kitchen, retreated to the bedroom. And from there, he cried suddenly,
"You can't even imagine how much I love you."
Leela placed the knife on the sink. She thought, "He doesn't believe that I'm leaving him. He wouldn't even believe that I have someone else. He can't."
Yet she got up her courage and went to the bedroom to confess to him about Nino, to tell him she was pregnant. But her husband was sleeping. He had fallen asleep as if wrapped in a magic cape. So she put on her coat, took the suitcase, and left the apartment.
89. Stefano slept all day. When he woke up and realized that his wife wasn't there, he pretended not to notice. He had behaved like that since he was a boy, when his father terrorized him by his mere presence, and he, in reaction, had trained himself to that half-smile, to slow, tranquil gestures, to a controlled distance from the world around him, to keep at bay both fear and the desire to tear open his chest with his bare hands and, pulling it apart, rip out the heart. In the evening, he went out and did something rash. He went to Ada's windows, and though he knew she was supposed to be at the movies or somewhere with Pasquale, he called her, kept calling her. Ada looked out, both happy and alarmed. She had stayed home because Melina was raving more than usual, and Antonio, ever since he had gone to work for the Salatas, was always out. He didn't have a schedule. Her fiancé was there keeping her company. Stefano went up just the same, and, without ever mentioning Leela, spent the evening at the Capuccio house, talking politics with Pasquale, and about matters connected to the grocery with Ada. When he got home, he pretended that Leela had gone to her parents, and before he went to bed, he shaved carefully. He slept heavily all night. The trouble began the next day. The assistant at Piazza dei Martiri told Michele that Leela hadn't shown up. Michele telephoned Stefano, and Stefano told him that his wife was sick. The illness lasted for days, so Nunzia stopped by to see if her daughter needed her. No one opened the door. She went back in the evening. Stefano had just returned from work and was sitting in front of the television, which was at high volume. He swore. He went to open the door, invited her in. As soon as Nunzia said, "How is Lena?" he answered that she had left him. Then he burst into tears. Both families hurried over. Stefano's mother, Alfonso, Pinuccio with the baby, Rino, Fernando. For one reason or another, they were all frightened. But only Maria and Nunzia were openly worried about Leela's fate and wondered where she had gone. The others quarreled for reasons that had little to do with her. Rino and Fernando, who were angry at Stefano because he had done nothing to prevent the closing of the shoe factory, accused him of having never understood Leela and said he had been very wrong to send her to the Salata's shop. Pinuccia got angry and yelled at her husband and her father-in-law that Leela had always been a hothead, that she wasn't Stefano's victim, Stefano was hers. When Alfonso ventured that they should turn to the police, ask at the hospitals, feelings flared up even more. They all criticized him as if he had insulted them. Rino in particular cried that the last thing they needed was to become the laughingstock of the neighborhood. It was Maria who said softly, "Maybe she's gone to stay with Lenu for a while." That hypothesis caught on. They continued to quarrel, but they all pretended, except Alfonso, to believe that Leela, because of Stefano and the Salatas, had decided to go to Pisa. "Yes," Nunzia said, calming down. "She always does that. As soon as she has a problem, she goes to Lenu." At that point, They all started to get angry about that reckless journey, all by herself, on the train, far away, without telling anyone. And yet, that Leela was with me seemed so plausible, and at the same time so reassuring, that it immediately became a fact. Only Alfonso said, "I'll leave tomorrow and go see." But he was immediately checked by Pinucha. "Where are you going when you have to work?" And by Fernando, who muttered, "Leave her alone. Let her calm down." The next day, that was the version that Stefano gave to anyone who asked about Leela. "She went to Pisa to see Lenu. She wants to rest." But that afternoon, Nunzio was gripped again by anxiety. She went to see Alfonso and asked if he had my address. He didn't have it. No one did. Only my mother. So Nunzia sent Alfonso to her. But my mother, out of her natural hostility toward everyone, or to safeguard my studies from distraction, gave him an incomplete version. It's likely that she herself had it that way. Writing was hard for my mother, and we both knew that she would never use that address. In any case, Nunzia and Alfonso together wrote me a letter, in which they asked, in a very roundabout way, if Leela was with me. They addressed it to the University of Pisa. Nothing else, only my name and surname, and its arrival was much delayed. I read it. I became even angrier with Leela and Nino. I didn't answer. Meanwhile, the day after Leela's so-called departure, Ada, in addition to working in the old grocery store, in addition to attending to her entire family and the needs of her fiancé, also began to tidy up Stefano's house and to cook for him, which put Pasquale in a bad mood. They quarreled. He said to her, "You're not paid to be a servant." And she answered, "Better to be a servant than waste time arguing with you." On the other hand, to keep the Saladas happy, Alfonso was quickly sent to Piazza dei Martiri, where he felt at his ease. He left early in the morning, dressed as if he were going to a wedding, and returned at night very pleased. He liked spending the day in the center. As for Michele, who, with the disappearance of Signora Caracci, had become intractable, he called Antonio and said to him, "Find her for me." Antonio muttered,
"Naples is big, Mike, and so is Pisa, and even Italy. Where do I begin?"
Michele answered, "With Sartore's oldest son." Then he gave him the look he reserved for people he considered worth less than nothing, and said, "Don't you dare tell anyone about this search, or I'll put you in the insane asylum in Aversa, and you'll never get out. Everything you know, everything you see, you will tell me alone. Is that clear?" Antonio nodded yes. 90. That people, even more than things, lost their boundaries and overflowed into shapelessness, is what most frightened Leela in the course of her life. The loss of those boundaries in her brother, whom she loved more than anyone in her family, had frightened her. And the disintegration of Stefano in the passage from fiancé to husband terrified her. I learned only from her notebooks how much her wedding night had scarred her, and how she feared the potential distortion of her husband's body, his disfigurement by the internal impulses of desire and rage, or, on the contrary, of subtle plans, base acts. Especially at night, she was afraid of waking up and finding him formless in the bed, transformed into excrescences that burst out because of too much fluid, the flesh melted and dripping, and with it, everything around. The furniture, the entire apartment, and she herself, his wife, broken, sucked into that stream polluted by living matter. When she closed the door behind her and, as if she were inside a white cloud of steam that made her invisible, took the metro to Campi Flegrei, Lila had the impression that she had left a soft space, inhabited by forms without definition, and was finally heading toward a structure that was capable of containing her fully, all of her, without her cracking or the figures around her cracking. She reached her destination along desolate streets. She dragged the suitcase to the third floor of a working-class apartment building and into a shoddy, dark two-room apartment furnished with old, cheap furniture. A bathroom where there was only a toilet and sink. She had done it all herself. Nino had to prepare for his exams, and he was also working on a new article for Il Mattino, and on transforming the other into an essay that had been rejected by Cronache Meridionale, but that a journal called Nord e Sud said it was eager to publish. She had seen the apartment, had rented it, had given 3 payments in advance. Now, as soon as she entered, she felt enormously cheerful. She discovered with surprise the pleasure of having abandoned those she thought would have to be part of her forever. Pleasure. Yes, she wrote just that. She didn't feel in the least the loss of the new neighborhood's comforts. She didn't smell the odor of mold, didn't see the stain of dampness in the corner of the bedroom, didn't notice the gray light that struggled to enter through the window. Wasn't depressed by a place that immediately foretold a return to the poverty of her childhood. Instead, she felt as if she had magically disappeared from a place where she suffered and had reappeared in a place that promised happiness. She was again fascinated, I think, by erasing herself. Enough with everything she had been. Enough with the stradone, shoes, groceries, husband, Salatas, Piazza dei Martiri. Enough even with me. Bride, wife, gone elsewhere, lost. All that remained of herself was the lover of Nino, who arrived that evening. He was visibly overcome by emotion. He embraced her, kissed her, looked around disoriented. He barred doors and windows as if he feared sudden incursions. They made love, in a bed for the first time after the night in Forio. Then he got up. He started studying. He complained often about the weak light. She also got out of bed and helped him review. They went to sleep at 3 in the morning, after revising together the new article for Il Mattino, and they slept in an embrace. Lila felt safe, although it was raining outside. The windows shook. The house was alien to her. How new Nino's body was. Long, thin, so different from Stefano's. How exciting his smell was. It seemed to her that she had come from a world of shadows and had arrived in a place where finally life was real. In the morning, as soon as she put her feet on the floor, she had to run to the toilet to throw up. She closed the door so that Nino wouldn't hear. 91. They lived together for 23 days. The relief at having left everything increased from moment to moment. She didn't miss any of the comforts she had enjoyed after her marriage, and separation from her parents, her younger siblings, Reno, her nephew, didn't sadden her. She never worried that the money would run out. The only thing that seemed to matter was that she woke up with Nino and fell asleep with him, that she was beside him when he studied or wrote, that they had lively discussions in which the jumble of thoughts in her head poured out. At night, they went to a movie together, or chose a book presentation, or a political debate. and often they stayed out late, returning home on foot, clinging to one another to protect themselves from the cold or the rain, squabbling, joking. Once they went to hear a writer named Pasolini, who also made films. Everything that had to do with him caused an uproar, and Nino didn't like him. He twisted his mouth, said, "He's a fairy. All he does is make a lot of noise." So he had resisted. He would have preferred to stay home and study. But Leela was curious, and she dragged him there. The talk was held in the same club where I had gone once, in obedience to Professor Galliani. Leela was enthusiastic when she came out. She pushed Nino toward the writer. She wanted to talk to him. But Nino was nervous and did his best to get her away, especially when he realized that on the sidewalk across the street, there were youths shouting insults. "Let's go," he said, worried. "I don't like him, and I don't like the fascists either." But Leela had grown up amid violence. She had no intention of sneaking off. He tried to pull her toward an alley, and she wriggled free. She laughed. She responded to the insults with insults. She gave in abruptly when, just as a real fight was starting, she recognized Antonio. His eyes and his teeth shone as if they were made of metal. But unlike the others, he wasn't shouting. He seemed too busy hitting people to be aware of her. But the thing ruined the evening for her anyway. On the way home, she felt some tension with Nino. They didn't agree about what Pasolini had said. They seemed to have gone to different places to hear different people. But it wasn't only that. That night, he regretted the long, exciting period of the furtive meetings in the shop on Piazza dei Martiri, and at the same time, perceived that something about Leela disturbed him. She noticed his distraction, his irritation, and to avoid further tension, did not say that among the attackers she had seen a friend of hers from the neighborhood, Melina's son. From then on, Nino seemed less and less inclined to take her out. First, he said that he had to study, and it was true. Then he let slip that on various public occasions, she had been excessive. "In what sense?" "You exaggerate."
"Meaning?"
He made a resentful list. "You make comments out loud. If someone tells you to be quiet, you start arguing. You bother the speakers with your own monologues. It's not done." Leela had known that it wasn't done. But she had believed that now, with him, everything was possible. Bridging gaps with a leap, speaking face to face with people who counted. Hadn't she been able to talk to influential types in the Salata shop? Hadn't it been thanks to one of the customers that he had published his first article in Il Mattino? And so?
"You're too timid," she said. "You still don't understand that you're better than they are, and you'll do much more important things." Then she kissed him. But the following evenings, Nino, with one excuse or another, began to go out alone. And if he stayed home instead and studied, he complained of how much noise there was in the building, or he grumbled because he had to go and ask his father for money, and Donato would torment him with questions like, "Where are you sleeping? What are you doing? Where are you living? Are you studying?" Or, in the face of Leela's ability to make connections between very different things, instead of being excited as usual, he shook his head, became irritable. After a while, he was in such a bad mood, and so behind with his exams, that in order to keep studying, he stopped going to bed with her. Leela said, "It's late. Let's go to sleep." He answered with a distracted, "You go. I'll come later." He looked at the outline of her body under the covers and desired its warmth,
but was also afraid of it. I haven't yet graduated, he thought. I don't have a job. If I don't want to throw my life away, I have to apply myself. Instead, I'm here with this person who is married, who is pregnant, who vomits every morning, who prevents me from being disciplined. When he found out that Il Mattino wouldn't publish the article, he was really upset. Lila consoled him, told him to send it to other newspapers. But then she added, "Tomorrow I'll call." She wanted to call the editor she had met in the Solara's shop and find out what was wrong. He stammered, "You won't telephone anyone."
"Why?"
"Because that shit was never interested in me, but in you."
"It's not true."
"It's very true. I'm not a fool. You just make problems for me."
"What do you mean?"
"I shouldn't have listened to you."
"What did I do?"
"You confused my ideas. Because you're like a drop of water. Ting, ting, ting. Until it's done your way, you won't stop."
"You thought of the article and wrote it."
"Exactly. And so why did you make me redo it 4 times?
"You wanted to rewrite it."
"Lena, let's be very clear. Choose something of your own that you like. Go back to selling shoes. Go back to selling salami. But don't desire to be something you're not by ruining me." They had been living together for 23 days, a cloud in which the gods had hidden them so that they could enjoy each other without being disturbed. Those words wounded her deeply. She said, "Get out." He quickly pulled his coat on over his sweater and slammed the door behind him. Lila sat on the bed and thought, "He'll be back in 10 minutes. He left his books, his notes, his shaving cream and razor." Then she burst into tears. "How could I have thought of living with him, of being able to help him? It's my fault. To free my head, I even made him write something wrong." She went to bed and waited. She waited all night, but Nino didn't come back. Not the morning after, or the one after that. 92. What I am now recounting, I learned from various people at various times. I begin with Nino, who left the house in Campi Flegrei and took refuge with his parents. His mother treated him better, much better than the prodigal son. With his father, on the other hand, he was quarreling within an hour. The insults flew. Donato yelled at him in dialect that he could either leave home or stay there, but the thing he absolutely could not do was to disappear for a month without telling anyone, and then return, only to swipe some money as if he had earned it himself. Nino retreated to his room and had many arguments with himself. Although he already wanted to run back to Lena, ask her pardon, cry to her that he loved her, he assessed the situation and became convinced that he had fallen into a trap. Not his fault, not Lena's fault, but the fault of desire. Now, for example, he thought, "I can't wait to go back to her, cover her with kisses, assume my responsibilities. But a part of me knows perfectly well that what I did today on a wave of disappointment is true and right. Lena isn't right for me. Lena is pregnant. What's in her womb scares me. So I must absolutely not return. I have to go to Bruno, borrow some money, leave Naples as Elena did, study somewhere else." He deliberated all night and all the next day, now pierced by a need for Lila, now clinging to chilling thoughts that evoked her crude ingenuousness, her too intelligent ignorance, the force with which she drew him into her thoughts, which seemed like insights, but were, instead, muddled. In the evening, he telephoned Bruno and, in a frenzy,
left to go see him. He ran through the rain to the bus stop, barely caught the right bus before it left. But suddenly he changed his mind and got off at Piazza Garibaldi. He took the metro to Campi Flegrei. He couldn't wait to embrace Leela, take her standing up, right away, as soon as he was in the house, against the entrance wall. That now seemed the most important thing. Then he would think what to do. It was dark. He walked with long strides in the rain. He didn't even notice the dark silhouette coming toward him. He was shoved so violently that he fell down. A long series of blows began, punching and kicking, kicking and punching. The person who hit him kept repeating, but not angrily, "Leave her, don't see her, and don't touch her again. Repeat, I will leave her. Repeat, I won't see her and I won't touch her again. You piece of shit. You like it, eh? Taking other men's wives. Repeat, I was wrong. I'll leave her." Nino repeated obediently, but his attacker didn't stop. He fainted, more out of fear than out of pain. 93. It was Antonio who beat up Nino, but he reported almost none of this to his boss. When Michele asked if he had found Salvatore's son, he answered yes. When he asked, with evident anxiety, if that track had led to Leela, he said no. When he asked him if he had had information about Leela, he said he couldn't find her, and the only thing he could absolutely rule out was that Salvatore's son had anything to do with Signora Caracci. He was lying, of course. He had found Nino and Leela fairly soon, by chance, the night he had had the job of brawling with the communists. He had smashed a few faces, and then had left the fight to follow the two who had fled. He had discovered where they lived. He had understood that they were living together. And in the following days, he had studied everything they did, how they lived. Seeing them, he had felt both admiration and envy. Admiration for Leela. How is it possible, he had said to himself, that she abandoned her house, a beautiful house, and left her husband, the groceries, the cars, the shoes, the saladas, for a student without a cent, who keeps her in a place almost worse than the old neighborhood? What is it with that girl? Courage or madness? Then he concentrated on his envy of Nino. What hurt him most was that Leela and I both liked the skinny, ugly bastard. What was it about the son of Salvatore? What was his advantage? He had thought about it night and day. He was gripped by a kind of morbid obsession that affected his nerves, especially in his hands, so that he was constantly interlacing them, pressing them together as if he were praying. Finally, he had decided that he had to free Leela, even if at that moment, perhaps, she had no desire to be freed. But, he had said to himself, it takes time for people to understand what's good and what's bad, and helping them means doing for them what, in a particular moment of their life, they aren't capable of doing. Michele Solata hadn't ordered him to beat up Salvatore's son. No. He had not told Michele the most important thing, and so there was no reason to go that far. Beating him up had been his own decision, and he had made it partly because he wanted to get Nino away from Leela and give her back what she had incomprehensibly thrown away, and partly for his own enjoyment, because of an exasperation he felt not toward Nino, an insignificant, limp agglomerate of effeminate flesh and bone, too long and breakable, but toward what we two girls had attributed and did attribute to him. I have to admit that when, sometime afterward, he told me that story, I seemed to understand his motivations. It moved me. I caressed his cheek to console him for his savage feelings. And he reddened. He was flustered.
To show me that he wasn't a beast, he said. Afterward, I helped him. He had picked up Salvatore's son, taken him, half-dazed, to a pharmacy, left him at the entrance, and returned to the neighborhood to talk to Pasquale and Enzo. They had agreed to meet him reluctantly. They no longer considered him a friend, especially Pasquale, even though he was his sister's fiancé. But Antonio didn't care. He pretended not to notice. He behaved as if their hostility because he had sold himself to the Saladas were a gripe that made no dent in their friendship. He said nothing about Nino. He focused on the fact that he had found Lila and that they had to help her. Do what? Pasquale had asked aggressively. Go home to her own house. She didn't go to see Lanucha. She's living in a shitty place in Campi Flegrei. By herself? Yes. And why in the world did she decide to do that? I don't know. I didn't talk to her. Why? I found her on behalf of Michele Salata. You're a shit fascist. I'm nothing. I did a job. Bravo. Now what do you want? I haven't told Michele that I found her. And so? I don't want to lose my job. I have to think of earning a living. If Michele finds out that I lied to him, he'll fire me. You go get her and bring her home. Pasquale had insulted him grossly again, but even then Antonio scarcely reacted. He became upset only when his future brother-in-law said that Lila had done well to leave her husband and all the rest. If she had finally gotten out of the Salata shop, if she realized that she had made a mistake in marrying Stefano, he certainly wouldn't be the one who brought her back. You want to leave her in Campi Flegrei by herself? Antonio asked, bewildered. Alone and without a lira? Why? Are we rich? Lina is a grown-up. She knows what life is. If she made that decision, she has her reasons. Let's leave her in peace. But she helped us whenever she could. At that reminder of the money Lila had given them, Pasquale was ashamed. He had stammered some trite stuff about rich and poor, about the condition of women in the neighborhood and outside it, about the fact that if it was a matter of giving her money, he was ready. But Enzo, who until then had been silent, broke in with a gesture of annoyance and said to Antonio, "Give me the address. I'm going to see what she intends to do." 94. He did go the next day. He took the metro, got out at Campi Flegrei and looked for the street, the building. Of Enzo at that time, I knew only that he couldn't tolerate anything anymore. The whining of his mother, the burden of his siblings, the camorra in the fruit and vegetable market, the rounds with the cart, which earned less and less, Pasquale's communist talk, and even his engagement to Carmen, none of it. But since he was reserved by nature, it was difficult to get an idea of what type of person he was. From Carmen, I had learned that he was secretly studying on his own. He wanted to get an engineering diploma. It must have been on the same occasion, Christmas, that Carmen told me he had kissed her only 4 times since he returned from military service in the spring. She added, with irritation, "Maybe he's not a man." That was what we often said, we girls, when someone didn't care much about us, that he wasn't a man. Enzo was, wasn't he? I didn't know anything about the dark depths that men could have. None of us did. And so, for any confusing manifestation, we had recourse to that formula. Some, like the Salatas, like Pasquale, Antonio, Donato Salvatore, even Franco Mari, my boyfriend at the Normale, wanted us in ways that were different, aggressive, subordinate, heedless, attentive. But that they wanted us, there was no doubt. Others, like Alfonso, Enzo, Nino, had,
according to equally diverse attitudes. An aloof self-possession, as if between us and them there were a wall, and the work of scaling it were our job. In Enzo, after the army, this characteristic had become accentuated. And he not only did nothing to please women, but did nothing to please the entire world. He was short, and yet his body seemed to have become even smaller, as if through a sort of self-compression, it had become a compact block of energy. The skin over the bones of his face was stretched like an awning, and he had reduced motion to the pure compass of his legs. No other part of him moved, not arms or neck or head, not even his hair, which was a reddish-blonde helmet. When he decided to go and see Leela, he told Pasquale and Antonio, not in order to discuss it, but in the form of a brief statement that served to cut off any discussion. Nor when he arrived at Campi Flegrei did he display any uncertainty. He found the street, found the doorway, went up the stairs, and rang with determination at the right door. 95. When Nino did not return in 10 minutes, or an hour, or even the next day, Leela turned spiteful. She felt not abandoned, but humiliated. And although she had admitted to herself that she wasn't the right woman for him, she still found it unbearable that he, disappearing from her life after only 23 days, had brutally confirmed it. In a rage, she threw away everything he had left. Books, underwear, socks, a sweater, even a pencil stub. She did it. She regretted it. She burst into tears. When finally the tears stopped, she felt ugly, swollen, stupid, cheapened by the bitter feelings that Nino, whom she loved, and by whom she believed she was loved in return, was provoking. The apartment seemed suddenly what it was, a squalid place through whose walls all the noises of the city reached her. She became aware of the bad smell, of the cockroaches that came in under the stairwell door, the stains of dampness on the ceiling, and felt, for the first time, that childhood was clutching at her again. Not the childhood of dreams, but the childhood of cruel privations, of threats and beatings. In fact, suddenly she discovered that one fantasy that had comforted us since we were children, to become rich, had evaporated from her mind. Although the poverty of Campi Flegrei seemed to her darker than in the neighborhood of our games, although her situation was worse because of the child she was expecting, although in a few days she had used up the money she had brought, she discovered that wealth no longer seemed a prize and a compensation. It no longer spoke to her. The creased and evil-smelling paper money, piling up in the drawer of the cash register when she worked in the grocery, or in the colored metal box of the shop in Piazza dei Martiri, that in adolescence replaced the strong boxes of our childhood, overflowing with gold pieces and precious stones, no longer functioned. Any remaining glitter was gone. The relationship between money and the possession of things had disappointed her. She wanted nothing for herself or for the child she would have. To be rich for her meant having Nino. And since Nino was gone, she felt poor, a poverty that no money could obliterate. Since there was no remedy for that new condition, she had made too many mistakes since she was a child, and they had all converged in that last mistake, to believe that the son of Sarratore couldn't do without her as she couldn't without him, and that theirs was a unique, exceptional fate, and that the good fortune of loving each other would last forever and would extinguish the force of any other necessity. She felt guilty and decided not to go out, not to look for him, not to eat, not to drink,
but to wait for her life and that of the baby to lose their outlines, any possible definition. And she found that there was nothing left in her mind, not even a trace of the thing that made her spiteful, that is to say, the awareness of abandonment. Then someone rang at the door. She thought it was Nino. She opened it. It was Enzo. Seeing him didn't disappoint her. She thought he had come to bring her some fruit, as he had done many years earlier, as a child, after he was defeated in the competition created by the principal and Maestra Oliviero, and had thrown a stone at her. And she burst out laughing. Enzo considered the laughter a sign of illness. He went in, but left the door open out of respect. He didn't want the neighbors to think she was receiving men like a prostitute. He looked around. He glanced at her disheveled state. And although he didn't see what still didn't show, that is, pregnancy, he deduced that she really needed help. In his serious way, completely without emotion, he said, even before she managed to calm down and stop laughing, "We're going now."
"Where?"
"To your husband."
"Did he send you?"
"No."
"Who sent you?"
"No one sent me."
"I'm not coming."
"Then I'll stay here with you."
"Forever?"
"Until you're persuaded."
"And your job?"
"I'm tired of it."
"And Carmen?"
"You are much more important."
"I'll tell her. Then she'll leave you."
"I'll tell her. I've already decided." From then on, he spoke distantly, in a low voice. She answered him, laughing in a teasing way, as if none of their words were real, as if they were speaking in fun of a world, of people, of feelings that hadn't existed for a long time. Enzo realized that, and for a while he said nothing more. He went through the house, found Leela's suitcase, filled it with the things in the drawers, in the closet. Leela let him do it, because she considered him not the flesh and blood Enzo, but a shadow in color, as in the movies, who, although he spoke, was nevertheless an effect of the light. Having packed the suitcase, Enzo confronted her again and made a very surprising speech. He said, in his concentrated yet detached way, "Leela, I've loved you since we were children. I never told you because you are very beautiful and very intelligent, and I am short, ugly, and worthless. Now return to your husband. I don't know why you left him, and I don't want to know. I know only that you can't stay here. You don't deserve to live in filth. I'll take you to the entrance of the building and wait. If he treats you badly, I'll come up and kill him. But he won't. He'll be glad you've come back. But let's make a pact. In the case that you can't come to an agreement with your husband, I brought you back to him, and I will come and get you. All right?" Leela stopped laughing. She narrowed her eyes. She listened to him attentively for the first time. Interactions between Enzo and her had been very rare until that moment, but the times I had been present, they had always amazed me. There was something indefinable between them, originating in the confusion of childhood. She trusted Enzo, I think. She felt she could count on him. When the young man took the suitcase and headed toward the door, which had remained open, she hesitated a moment, then followed him. 96. Enzo did wait under Leela and Stefano's windows the night he took her home. And if Stefano had beaten her, he probably would have gone up and killed him. But Stefano didn't beat her. He welcomed her into her home, which was clean and tidy. He behaved as if his wife really had gone to stay with me in Pisa.
even if there was no evidence that that was what had happened. Leela, on the other hand, did not take refuge in that excuse or any other. The following day, when she woke up, she said reluctantly, "I'm pregnant." And he was so happy that when she added, "The baby isn't yours," he burst out laughing with genuine joy. When she angrily repeated that phrase once, twice, three times, and even tried to hit him with clenched fists, he cuddled her, kissed her, murmuring, "Enough, Leela. Enough, enough. I'm too happy. I know that I've treated you badly, but now let's stop. Don't say mean things to me." And his eyes filled with tears of joy. Leela knew that people tell themselves lies to defend against the truth of the facts, but she was amazed that her husband was able to lie to himself with such joyful conviction. On the other hand, she didn't care by now about Stefano or about herself. And after again repeating for a while, without emotion, "The baby isn't yours," she withdrew into the lethargy of pregnancy. "He prefers to put off the pain," she thought. "And all right, let him do as he likes. If he doesn't want to suffer now, he'll suffer later." She went on to make a list of what she wanted and what she didn't want. She didn't want to work in the shop in Piazza dei Martiri or in the grocery. She didn't want to see anyone, friends, relatives, especially the Salatas. She wished to stay home and be a wife and mother. He agreed, sure that she would change her mind in a few days. But Leela secluded herself in the apartment, without showing any interest in Stefano's business, or that of her brother and her father, or in the affairs of his relatives or of her own relatives. A couple of times Pinuccia came with her son, Fernando, whom they called Dino, but she didn't open the door. Once Reno came, very upset, and Leela let him in, listened to all his chatter about how angry the Salatas were about her disappearance from the shop, about how badly things were going with Cerullo shoes, because Stefano thought only of his own affairs and was no longer investing. When at last he was silent, she said, "Reno, you're the older brother. You're a grown-up. You have a wife and son. Do me a favor. Live your life without constantly turning to me." He was hurt, and he went away depressed. After a complaint about how everyone was getting richer, while he, because of his sister, who didn't care about the family, the blood of the Cerullos, but now felt she was a Caracci, was in danger of losing the little he had gained. It happened that even Michele Salata went to the trouble of coming to see her, in the beginning even twice a day, at times when he was sure that Stefano wouldn't be there. But she never let him in. She sat silently in the kitchen, almost without breathing, so that once, before he left, he shouted at her from the street, "Who the fuck do you think you are, whore? You had an agreement with me, and you didn't keep it." Leela welcomed willingly only Nunzia and Stefano's mother Maria, both of whom followed her pregnancy closely. She stopped throwing up, but her complexion remained gray. She had the impression of having become large and inflated inside rather than outside, as if within the wrapping of her body, every organ had begun to fatten. Her stomach seemed a bubble of flesh that was expanding because of the baby's breathing. She was afraid of that expansion. She feared that the thing she was most afraid of would happen. She would break apart, overflow. Then suddenly she felt that the being she had inside, that absurd modality of life, that expanding nodule that at a certain point would come out of her sex like a puppet on a string. Suddenly, she loved it, and through it the sense of herself returned. Frightened by her ignorance, by the mistakes she could make, she began to read everything she could find about what pregnancy is, what happens inside the womb, how to prepare for the birth. She hardly went out at all in those months. She stopped buying clothes or objects for the house. She got in the habit instead of having her mother bring at least a couple of newspapers and Alfonso some journals. It was the only money she spent. Once Carmen showed up to ask for money, and she told her to ask Stefano. She had none. The girl went away discouraged. She didn't care about anyone anymore, only the baby. The experience wounded Carmen, who became even more resentful. She still hadn't forgiven Leela for breaking up their alliance in the new grocery. Now she couldn't forgive her for not opening her purse. But mainly, she couldn't forgive her because, as she began to gossip to everyone, she had done as she liked. She had vanished. She had returned. And yet she continued to play the part of the lady, to have a nice house, and now even had a baby coming. The more of a slut you are, the better off you are. She, on the other hand, who labored from morning to night with no gratification, only bad things happened to her, one after the other. Her father died in jail. Her mother died in that way she didn't even want to think about. And now Enzo as well. He had waited for her one night outside the grocery and told her that he didn't want to continue the engagement. Just like that. Very few words. As usual, no explanation. She had run weeping to her brother, and Pasquale had met Enzo to ask for an explanation. But Enzo had given none, so now they didn't speak to each other. When I returned from Pisa for Easter vacation and met Carmen in the gardens, she vented. "I'm an idiot," she wept, "waiting for him the whole time he was a soldier. An idiot, slaving from morning to night for practically nothing." She said she was tired of everything. And with no obvious connection, she began to insult Leela. She went so far as to ascribe to her a relationship with Michele Solada, who had often been seen wandering around the Caracci house. "Adultery and money," she hissed. "That's how she gets ahead." Not a word, however, about Nino. Miraculously, the neighborhood knew nothing of that. During the same period, Antonio told me about beating him up, and about how he had sent Enzo to retrieve Leela, but he told only me, and I'm sure that for his whole life, he never spoke a word to anyone else. But I learned something from Alfonso. Insistently questioned, he told me he had heard from Marisa that Nino had gone to study in Milan. Thanks to them, when on Holy Sunday I ran into Leela on the Stradone, completely by chance, I felt a subtle pleasure at the idea that I knew more than she about the facts of her life, and that from what I knew, it was easy to deduce how little good it had done her to take Nino away from me. Her stomach was already quite big. It was like an excrescence on her thin body. Even her face didn't show the florid beauty of pregnant women. It was ugly, greenish, the skin stretched over the prominent cheekbones. We both tried to pretend that nothing had happened. "How are you?"
"Well."
"Can I touch your stomach?"
"Yes."
"And that matter?"
"Which?"
"The one on Ischia."
"It's over."
"Too bad."
"What are you doing?"
"I study. I have a place of my own and all the books I need. I even have a sort of boyfriend."
"A sort?"
"Yes."
"What's his name?"
"Franco Mari."
"What does he do?"
"He's also a student."
"Those glasses really suit you."
"Franco gave them to me."
"And the dress?"
"Also him."
"He's rich?"
"Yes."
"I'm glad. And how is the studying going?"
"I work hard. Otherwise, they'll send me away."
Be careful.
I'm careful.
Lucky you.
Well. She said her due date was in July. She had a doctor,